Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll go in a moment to Moscow and talk with Nikolai Goshkov, who is the head of the BBC's monitoring unit in Moscow. They monitor all Russian broadcasts and create a digest both for the BBC and for others. So he's the ideal person to talk to about President Bush's trip. He just had dinner with Vladimir Putin and his wife, and we'll be talking about the way the Russian press has covered the event, which has started out as a celebration of the two allies having conquered Nazi Germany in World War II. It's turned into a diplomatic disaster. So we'll be looking into that and also into the state of the press in Russia since it's been chilled and cowed by Vladimir Putin. We'll also talk with Professor Norman Dumby, who's a professor emeritus of theoretical physics at the University of Sussex. He's an expert in arms control and nuclear non-proliferation. He's the author of a piece that appeared in the London Review of Books, Iraq's Nuclear Incapacity. And we're talking to him about the leaked memo that has caused Tony Blair a lot of problems. This was a memo of a secret Downing Street meeting that took place in the Prime Minister's office at number 10 Downing Street on July 23rd, 2002, where the head of British intelligence, the equivalent of the head of the CIA, briefed Tony Blair and the secretary, the foreign secretary, Jack Straw, about his recent trip to Washington, where he met with George Tenet and other Bush administration officials. So we'll be talking about the effect of this leak in British politics and an extraordinary silence over here in the United States since the documents actually indict the Bush administration. And finally, we'll talk with Bradley Martin, who is a former foreign correspondent from Asia. He worked for the Asian Wall Street Journal. And the number of Asian newspapers. And he has written a book about Kim Jong-il, the North Korean dictator, under the loving care of the fatherly leader. And we'll be talking to Bradley Martin in the last segment about Kim Jong-il's apparent intention to test a nuclear weapon. I'm now speaking with Nikolai Goshkov, who is in Moscow, where he's the head of the BBC's monitoring unit. And this is a group that monitor Russian broadcasts for both the BBC and for other customers. And Nikolai, I guess you've just seen on Russian state television George Bush and Vladimir Putin and their wives kissing and holding hands. Is that the way it's being presented?
Yes, that's right, absolutely. Actually, as we speak right now, the Russian television is showing those pictures again. It's another news bulletin right now on air on Russian television. Yes, and Putin and Bush, both presidents, appear to be on very friendly terms. Indeed, they've been chatting to each other, apparently without any help from interpreters, because we know that President Putin has been taking English lessons ever since he became president, actually.
Of course, President Bush does not speak Russian.
No, well,
he barely speaks English.
But he seemed to be quite interested in President Putin's sort of trapping through presidential power. He discussed his working desk with President Putin, asking. Apparently, we couldn't hear anything that they said, but from the gesticulation and sort of
the body language, right?
And the body language, yeah.
But tell me though,
they were discussing the materials of which the desk was made, and then President Putin described, showed the map of Russia hanging on the wall, describing the size of the country and apparently some of the parts which Russia lost recently.
Bigger than Texas. Tell me though, this trip supposedly was supposed to be to celebrate the fact that the Allies, the Americans and the British, and the Russians defeated Nazi Germany. So instead of it being a celebration of an alliance that that both sides are trying to renew, it's become a diplomatic landmine, has it not?
Well, yes, actually, President Putin himself appears to be playing down this sort of remarks about Soviet occupation of the Baltic states, which really created this row, diplomatic row between the two countries, because all of the Russian press and a lot of Russian politicians are up in arms saying that there was no occupation of the Baltic states. The Baltic states did belong to the Soviet Union, to the former Russian Empire, and actually it was acknowledged by the Allies at Yalta and Potsdam peace conferences in 1945, when both Roosevelt and Churchill, and later Truman and Attlee for Britain, they actually acknowledged that the Baltic states were part of the Soviet Union. No other than Mikhail Gorbachev, the ex-Soviet president who started Perestroika and opening up to the West, he was a guest in the studio saying that there was no question, there was no occupation whatsoever, and for those politicians, without giving any names, though, he made it clear that he was not naming anybody, but he said that some politicians appear to be very weak in international politics, and since this is springtime, this disease is being aggravated as sort of on a yearly basis, so to speak.
Well, however, Vladimir Putin has recently said, in a speech he recently gave, he said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was one of the great disasters of history, I believe I'm quoting him correctly. He also
absolutely, yes.
He also said that the Hitler-Stalin Pact was a good idea. I mean, how do you separate the heroism of the Soviet people, 26 million of whom died in World War II, from the crimes of Stalin?
That's the biggest sort of dilemma facing up a lot of Russians. And there's a huge debate going on in the country, especially since the Communist Party of Russia have initiated sort of the re-erection of monuments to Stalin, especially in Moscow and elsewhere. And actually, today in Yakutia, of all the places, it's in eastern Siberia, well, closer to the United States than Moscow is. They've actually reinstated a statue of Stalin in their regional capital. So there's a very lively discussion of whether it was Stalin's, mainly it was due to Stalin that the Soviet Union won the war over fascist Germany, or was it the heroism of the Soviet people, not just the Russians, but all the people of the Soviet Union. So, yes, it's the biggest question, and it appears to be unresolved, and I doubt if it is going to be resolved in the nearest future.
Well, of course, Nikolai Gorshkov, the main question that springs to mind is, where does Putin stand on this? Is he a closet Stalinist, or is he a reformer? And in the context of revisiting history, which this celebration of the 60th anniversary of the end of World War II seems to have done, the Japanese government has been in trouble recently with the Chinese and the South Koreans about textbooks glossing over their atrocities in World War II. The German people after World War II treated both the Russians and the Americans as conquerors. They didn't consider themselves being liberated, and nevertheless they went through a period of re-education that was pretty comprehensive. Vladimir Putin himself, when he served in the KGB in East Germany, was his nickname was the German, and I'm wondering where he stands on the idea. Is this a broader Russian problem, that a country whose culture is in fact divided between the victims and the victimizers of Stalin? Are they actively trying to do something about it, or are they just keep sort of sweeping it under the rug?
No, the country appears to be split right down the middle. Obviously, in the words of a famous Russian poet, Anna Akhmatova, after Stalin's death, when a lot of political prisoners were let out of the prisons, she famously said that now the two Russias, the two Russias would meet each other and look right in the eyes of each other. Those who were imprisoned and those who imprisoned them, because basically there were only two categories in the Soviet Union under Stalin: the inmates and their guards. And that's, I think, the legacy of this lives to this day. And, of course, President Putin, I think he's simply reflecting this great divide in Russia. I think he's very, very attentive to the swings in public mood. And when he felt this nostalgia for the old Soviet anthem, which is really a stirring up melody. He actually initiated the reintroduction of the old Soviet anthem as the Russia's new anthem. Mm-hmm. And he had great support from a lot of people who were actually looking back to the great days of the Soviet might. Now, half of the country was against it again. Well, roughly half of the country was against it. But then he actually, to please them, he introduced some of the more liberal reforms, especially in economics. Then he swung back when he arrested Mikhail Khodorkovsky, one of the richest men in Russia and an oil magnate. So if you watch over a period of time Putin's steps, he always counterbalances whatever he does to placate this sort of old guard, the orthodoxy of the ex-Soviet days. He always counterbalances this with some sort of more liberal steps, especially in the economic life of the country. I think he's trying to reflect this in his policies, but of course there are two camps behind him who are fighting really hard for one of them to win over, and that's the problem with Russian politics, because it appears to a lot of people that the hardliner camps is winning over gradually, but slowly but gradually.
I think the Russian, the anthem you refer to was written by Kondalovsky, wasn't it? His sons are the two movie directors.
Say it again, please.
Mikhalkov, yeah, wrote the anthem.
Oh,
and his two sons are famous movie directors. But let me ask you though about whether or not Putin is using the sort of xenophobia about events in Georgia and the Ukraine, and now President Bush stirring the pot in Latvia. Is this in any ways a way to distract the Russian people from the real problems which the Kremlin should be dealing with, which are the pension system and the broken healthcare system? So is there some, in effect, people have accused over here have accused George Bush of getting us distracted in a war, so that he doesn't have to deal with Medicare, and that his Social Security reform is supposedly a way to distract people from other issues.
Well, to a lot of critics of President Putin, the biggest distraction right now is this grand celebration of the 60th anniversary of the victory over fascist Germany, because they say, well, ever since then, there's nothing to celebrate. That was the biggest achievement by the country. And ever since, for the past 60 years, there were no other achievements, well, except for Gagarin sort of being the first man in space, or some sort of nuclear testing, kind of things like that. There was nothing on the scale of the victory in the Second World War that Russia could really be proud of. And that's why a lot of sort of attention and effort is being channeled by the authorities into this celebration. But on a wider scale, the thing is that people are really, a lot of people are more and more distraught at by the events that are happening right now in the country. The expected prosperity hasn't filtered down through to them. I've talked to a lot of people, and if you read the Russian press, you'd see that there's a lot of support for what the authorities did to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the richest man in Russia, because people do not really like them, those who made fortunes during the years of privatization of national state assets in the country. And there's great nostalgia for the good old days of the Soviet Union. People tend to forget all the hardship they went through regarding food shortages and lack of basic amenities. Now all they remember is the secure future, secure jobs, paychecks on time, although meager they were, but I mean, everything was free to them, like public healthcare and education and everything. People tend to forget that it was paid out of their sort of unpaid salaries, because their salaries were so meager. But as I say, and the biggest disappointment for a lot of people was, of course, this disillusion, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the biggest disappointment again was then when the country opened up, a lot of people thought that the West would embrace them and sort of make them their sort of part of their family of free, democratic, prosperous nations. Now that people have to queue for visas to go to any country in Europe, let alone America or elsewhere in the world, now that people see that NATO is sort of coming closer to their borders, when they've dissolved the Warsaw Pact, there's a lot of resentment, actually, frankly speaking, towards the West, because to a lot of Russians, the West did not actually embrace Russia. They did not let it into its fold. And now they are trying to kind of persuade themselves that actually Russia has its own way in history. Russia has its own destiny, and it does not have to be part of the West, because the West does not really want Russia to be part of the West.
And Nikolai, does the fact that Khodorkovsky's jailing is popular, obviously you could also argue that he's being scapegoated, and there's a far greater problem, which is that the KGB seem to be taking over, and that the bureaucracy has doubled to 1.2 million during Putin's 5 years here, and there's obviously a lot of corruption and incompetence there. So what about is there anybody in the press, or is there any, I guess the broader question is, where is Putin's enemies? I mean, you'd ask this question over here in the United States, is where are the Democrats vis-a-vis George Bush? But my question to you is, where are the Democrats or the supporters of democracy in Russia vis-a-vis Putin's drift into the clutches of the KGB?
Well, obviously they are in a disarray. The two liberal parties, they lost the election 2 years ago dismally, and they have no seats in parliament anymore, and they are in total disarray. But they appear to be in a minority. Now, the biggest threat to Putin right now comes from the general public, those pensioners and people on state wages and salaries, because of the recent painful economic reforms, when they've swapped benefits they would get into sort of money payouts, which are not cash payouts, which are not nearly enough to cover for the benefits that they've lost. And there was this spontaneous wave of protests across the country, which was really, which really took the authorities by surprise. And, well, there was this famous saying by somebody, a Russian sort of an opposition politician. He was kind of referring to this orange and rose revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine and elsewhere in the post-Soviet republics, saying that, well, if there is a color revolution, if there is going to be a colored revolution in Russia, along the lines of the Rose Revolution in Georgia or the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, it is going to come from the provinces, not from the capital, because people in the provinces are really, really disillusioned with Putin's policies now. And to a lot of commentators, Putin's star appears to be on the wane now. Hence, probably, his concentration more on foreign politics, because this appears to be sort of his success land. We started our discussion with Putin-Bush summit in Moscow right now. Actually, Putin was adamant, stressing that Russia valued partnership with the United States very much. He said that he's hosting a lot of foreign dignitaries for the celebrations in Moscow, but the visit by the U.S. president is extremely important. It's probably the most important visit these days. And he said Russia and the U.S. had a lot of common problems and a lot of desire to solve them together. And actually, he said that the two main things that they could work on was security and energy security, but, well, hinting that Russia was willing to provide more energy resources to the United States. But also he hinted that he was expecting U.S. help in solving some of the social issues in Russia. So Putin appears to be sort of staking his political fortune from now on the success of his relationships with the United States and Western Europe.
Well, he should be mindful of Tony Blair. I thank you very much for joining us. I wish we had more time to talk, particularly Nikolai Goskov, about the effect of Putin's corralling the press, because Putin himself recently said he wishes there was more diversity in the press in Russia. So obviously it's a very puzzling situation there. Do you have a quick one-word answer here to me, where it's heading?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, especially on issues of democracy, press, things like that, he appears to say one thing and do quite the opposite. The press has been really, really brought to heel by the Kremlin. If you watch all national major TV channels, and these are the media which are really influencing the public opinion here, you can easily see through that their agenda is being set not by the editorial boards, but by the Kremlin, and that's only too obvious.
I thank you so much for joining us, Nikolai Goshkov from Moscow, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. So just speaking there with Nikolai Goshkov, who heads up the BBC's monitoring unit in Moscow. They monitor all Russian broadcasts and newspapers. And we were talking about President Bush and Vladimir Putin and their wives meeting and having dinner tonight in Moscow. I'm now speaking with Professor Norman Dombey, who is a professor emeritus of theoretical physics at the University of Sussex, where he's a specialist also in arms control and nuclear non-proliferation. And also he wrote a piece in the London Review of Books some time back, Iraq's Nuclear Incapacity. And obviously in England today, there is a lot of talk about the leak of this memo from a meeting that took place in July the 23rd of 2002 in number 10 Downing Street, where the head of MI6, whose name is Dearlove, returned from a meeting in Washington with his counterpart at the CIA, George Tenet, and other Bush administration officials. And in this leaked memo, Dearlove says to Tony Blair in the meeting at number 10 that basically the President Bush is going to go ahead and have this war, and that he's going to fix the policy around, fix the intelligence around the policy. Tell me about, one would think that this would be a big story over here in the United States. It's been a big story in England. Where does it stand now since Blair did get reelected, but he lost half of his seats? So did this memo, play any role in Blair's, loss of power?
Yeah, Iraq was a very important element in the recent election. There was a liability to the Labour Party because in many constituencies which voted Labour, people refused to vote for Blair precisely because of Iraq. Not only the memo you quote, but the Attorney General's opinion, which was not given to Parliament, and which was not even shown to the cabinet, but it was leaked just a week before the election. And it showed that, contrary to what the Attorney General said to Parliament, he thought that the war was illegal under international law.
Well, also in this meeting at number 10, Jack Straw, the foreign minister, was there in attendance, and Straw said that the Bush case for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was very thin, and Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, and Iran. This is not news to the British public, but the Prime Minister, unlike President Bush, seems to have paid again a price for this.
Well, he paid a price. A lot of people would have preferred him to have resigned a year ago when all this was becoming clear. He didn't. And he's paid a price. It's not an absolute price. He wasn't booted out of office, but that was basically because the British people didn't like the leader of the Conservatives, Michael Howard, either.
And the Liberal Democrats a bit of a...
Other than the Liberal Democrats, who were never going to win the election.
Right. Their leader is I think, a bit of an incompetent, frankly. So he's still... He may be a fading star, but he's still something of a star, I guess. But again, why is it, I guess this is a question I should ask myself or my audience, why is it here in the United States? Here we have such strong evidence that President Bush cynically got this country into war and had every intention of going to war well before they even went to the United Nations, which they were reluctant to do, and that they clearly... fix their intelligence, and perhaps I think there's evidence that they forged and created a lot of their own intelligence. Do you have any thoughts of why there's no more outrage here in the United States, given that there's apparently a lot of outrage in England?
Well, I think it was different in the United States. President Bush told everyone that his intention was regime change. And Congress agreed that he could do what he liked on this. It was really Congress's fault, I think, that they gave him all this power on such flimsy evidence. In Britain, it was different. In Britain, Blair lied. He had to lie. Because Britain believes in international law, unlike many elements in the United States. And so it had to justify itself. It had to justify to Parliament that what it was doing was legal under international law. In order to do that, regime change isn't legal. The Attorney General said that, and the House of Commons would have said that. And so there had to be another reason, and the reason was Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. They were meant to be a significant threat to the United Kingdom. There were these stories of chemical weapons which could be fired at 45 minutes notice on Cyprus, where there are UK forces. And it was this which persuaded the House of Commons to back him.
And now
everyone is very annoyed because it's clearly not true. It clearly wasn't true.
Well, on this side, we've had an investigation into Curveball's documents. It turns out he was a brother of Chalabi's main aide in a German refugee camp. He was fed through German intelligence. But what the neocons who run American policy do is they somehow get this information, as with the Niger documents, and perhaps they create them themselves. There's a good deal of evidence that that is probably what happened. And then they feed them through a foreign intelligence service, but make sure that it doesn't go through the normal chain of command through the intelligence systems, either DIA or CIA, so that this stuff wouldn't pass the laugh test if professional intelligence officers looked at it. In fact, the Niger document was looked at by Mohammed El Baradei, the head of the IAEA, and 10 minutes later he declared it a crude forgery. So what do you know about the forgers on your side?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I said back in September 2002, when I wrote an article about that you referred to on Iraq's nuclear weapons, saying that they didn't have any and that they were much less of a threat in 2002 than they were in 1991. And that was because the UN inspectors had totally dismantled all their nuclear facilities and taken away all their nuclear material. So as far as Niger is concerned, I said in the article that I didn't believe this link that Iraq had wanted to buy uranium from Niger for two very simple reasons. It already had hundreds of tons of uranium, which didn't threaten anyone because they didn't have any enrichment capability, and also because they weren't responsible for the uranium mines in Niger. The French run those. So it sounded very, what we say, call fishy. Is Christian an American word, too?
Yes, it is an American word. And furthermore, in President Bush's State of the Union, where he mentioned that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy significant quantities of uranium from an African country, he attributed that to the British.
Yeah.
And prior to Bush making this announcement, the White House, through the CIA, had sent Ambassador Joe Wilson to Niger to investigate these claims. He came back and said it's completely preposterous. And then when he saw Bush's State of the Union, he was moved to write an op-ed piece in the New York Times, which then angered the contradicting Bush. That angered the White House, and then they revealed the identity of his wife, who's a CIA operative, and there's a special prosecutor looking into that. Although they're not sweating the White House, they're sweating a couple of reporters, one of whom didn't write the story. So who knows where that's going? But the long and the short of it is that, in fact, it turns out it was John Bolton who insisted that this be included in President Bush's speech. So how did Bush, how was he able to attribute this bogus Niger story to the British?
Well, it appeared in the September dossier that I was talking about.
Oh, I see.
So that's where it came from. I don't know. I assumed, actually, that it had been manufactured by the British. The British MI6 has a history of manufacturing and false information, going back to the Zinoviev letter, which brought down the first Labour government. But evidently, evidently that may not be the case. It may well have been Iraqi exiles, and I've heard that maybe it was forged in the U.S.
Well, that was that was broken on my program, I think about a month ago. So, you know, we're still trying to pin that one down. CBS the News has a program called 60 Minutes that have the story, but CBS Corporate have spiked the story. Again, you know, we're looking here in the United States, we're looking to Britain as an example of a country where there's more truth-telling, more accountability, and more outrage.
Well, there's certainly outrage because we don't. The MPs who voted for the motion, lots of them Labour MPs, to allow Blair to join Bush in Iraq, were outraged that there wasn't a 45-minute threat. What chemical weapons that weren't there, but which might have been there, were only battlefield weapons. They were shells. There was never any missile-capable weapons which could have hit Cyprus. So the whole thing was nonsense. And, of course, Iraq didn't have any usable chemical weapons either. And also, as I said earlier, the MPs were fairly furious, not as furious as they were on the chemical weapons, but fairly furious that they didn't have the whole legal opinion. That only was leaked a week before the election.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Norman Dombey, who's Professor Emeritus of Theoretical Physics at the University of Sussex. He's also a specialist in arms control and nuclear nonproliferation, and the author of an article that appeared some time ago in the London Review of Books, Iraq's Nuclear Incapacity. We're talking about the leak of a Prime Minister's meeting on July the 23rd, 2002, at which the Defense Secretary's Foreign Secretary, Attorney General, Sir Richard Wilson, John Scarlett, Francis Richards, CDS, that's a code, and C, of course, C is the head of MI6, Jonathan Powell, Sally Morgan.
C is 007.
Yeah, and yes, and then Alistair Campbell. So this memo is so clear that the British are completely skeptical and of the intentions and the honesty of the Bush administration in going to war. And they're openly talking about how they're fixing the intelligence around the policy, and how Iraq doesn't have any WMD and it's much less of a threat than Libya, North Korea, and Iran. Yet they went to war. So this is the sort of $64,000 question, if you will. Why did Tony Blair, when he knew that this was bogus, why did he go along with Bush?
Well, I'm not sure what Blair new. Blair is remarkably able to convince himself about anything, I think. He lied, certainly. There's a very simple instance of that. On the 7th of September 2002, Blair met Bush at Camp David, and Blair said, apropos of nuclear weapons, Iraqi nuclear weapons, Blair said, the threat from Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, potentially nuclear weapons capability, that threat is real. We need only to look at the report from the International Atomic Energy Agency this morning showing what has been going on at the former nuclear weapon sites to realize that. But there wasn't any report from the IAEA that morning. He was either inventing it or he was totally... he was briefed by incompetence. Bush made some similar remarks. Bush said that Iraq was only 6 months away from a nuclear bomb. But Bush was actually reporting from an IAEA statement back in 1996, which referred to the situation in 1991. So both were lying. Whether either of them knew they were lying, I don't know. But it was clearly why it's clear why they were lying, because Andrew Card, who was the
chief of staff,
had decided to market the Iraqi threat, and he had said, from a marketing point of view, you don't initiate new products in August. So, at the beginning of September 2002. Bush and nearly all his top advisors began to talk about the dangers of an Iraqi nuclear bomb. That included Blair. So why they were talking about a nuclear bomb is clear. They were clearly overemphasizing any possible intelligence, because I knew, and I didn't have any access to top secret intelligence, that Iraq didn't have any nuclear capability. And there were Iraqi exiles in Canada who had actually worked in the Iraqi nuclear program and knew that there was nothing, there was no threat. So why the CIA and MI6 didn't actually talk to the Iraqi exiles who knew what the situation was, what one doesn't know.
Well, the CIA being blamed for everything that went wrong, but they were kept out of the picture because the neocons had their own intelligence shop in the Pentagon run by Doug Feith. And they avoided feeding this bogus intelligence through the CIA because they knew it wouldn't pass the laugh test. So that's basically the methodology of lying to the American people, manufacturing their own evidence to create this war.
Okay, and maybe the Niger story was somehow passed through MI6.
Well,
I still would very much like to know how that happened, because, as I said, it was obvious nonsense right from the beginning.
Well, it was certainly passed through the Italian SISMI, and they staged a break-in at the Niger embassy in Rome to make it look like the documents came from there. But again, I'm still puzzled, having read this top secret memo that from the Prime Minister's meeting of the 23rd of July 2002, where everybody is expressing skepticism at the motives of the United States wanting to go to war against Saddam. But nevertheless, they go along with the war, the march to war. They let slip the dogs of war, as Shakespeare said. And now Blair has paid a price for it. So again, I'm just absolutely mystified of what it was that Blair, why he stuck his neck out for Bush, because he's not gotten anything out of it.
Well, I think he's thought, and I don't understand why, because Britain in the past, has British prime ministers in the past, have prided themselves usually on their special relationship with the U.S. Mrs. Thatcher is a good example. that they haven't actually followed the U.S. like poodles. They have been critical, and where necessary, they've distanced themselves from the U.S. I remember when I was a student during the Vietnam War, Harold Wilson had always refused to send any UK troops to Vietnam. And he was put under great pressure by Lyndon Johnson to send the troops, but he always refused.
Right, and Lyndon Johnson opened up the hamburger market here in the United States for Australia in order to induce them to send troops to Vietnam. So I guess there wasn't any quid pro quo over that.
Right. I don't understand. He was clearly given bad political advice. He was presumably told that by his political advisors that we have to keep close to the U.S. on this. But it didn't make sense to me to so unconditionally agree so early, back in early 2002, that the UK should go with the US no matter what.
I think any
other prime minister would have agreed, but said, to go along with Bush, but said, but we have to have the following before we can actually sign off on the deal. Right. And there would have been some sort of insistence that their evidence on weapons of mass destruction was real.
Well, I just in closing, I guess the only thing that I can suppose is that Blair just liked the idea of being a big player on the world stage, and if you want to be a big player on the world stage, you have to stand next to the 900-pound gorilla.
Yeah,
which is the president of the United States. So I thank you very much for joining us for filling us in on events in England, which, as I mentioned earlier, there's far more democracy going on over there, both in the public and the press, than we have here in the United States. And again, I thank you, Professor Norman Dunby, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Professor Norman Dunby. He's Professor Emeritus of Theoretical Physics at the University of Sussex, where he's an expert in arms control and nuclear non-proliferation. He's the author of Iraq's Nuclear Incapacity, which appeared in the London Review of Books some time back. I'm now speaking with Bradley Martin, who is an expert on North Korea. He was served as the Asia Bureau Chief and Editor of Newsweek and the Asian Wall Street Journal, and he has a new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. And Bradley, there are evidence apparently from spy satellites that the North Koreans are preparing for a nuclear test outside of the town of Kilju. Apparently they put up a reviewing stand, which they've done in the past, and I guess that indicates that they may be ready to test. What's your reading on the likelihood of a nuclear test?
It's hard to say. The North Koreans do realize that American spy satellites are watching them, and so everything they do is going to be noted and built up. And you know they can use this to manipulate if they wish. There are different views on this. Some people say that there are certain pieces of equipment that are not there that would be needed if they were going to actually have a test.
Well, it's let's just assume that he's going ahead, and I don't see any reason why he shouldn't. He's apparently, you know, there were estimates some time ago from the CIA that he had two weapons. Now the Defense Intelligence Agency estimates he has up to 15. They've spy satellites have noticed that the steam's no longer coming out of the reactor, which indicates it's been shut down. So they think that it's going to take out the fuel rods, which would have a lot of plutonium to process for more bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And now the evidence that they're digging a big hole outside of Kilju, which I believe is actually a fairly populated area. So it seems consistent with the fact that it seems to me that the United States has put itself in the situation where Kim Jong-il only has the nuclear card to play.
Well, that's probably true. For example, President Bush, in his recent press conference, used a lot of a very negative language in talking about Kim Jong-il.
And he knows that makes him mad, right?
He knows that, and he has he's been called on it before by his professional diplomats and promised to stop doing it, but now he clearly has decided to do it again.
Well, diplomat is not a word that you could normally associate with this bunch in the White House. I mean, here we have a complete fiasco in Russia, where there was the two allies that fought the Nazis and won World War II are supposed to be celebrating. And instead of celebrating, the diplomatic mishandling of it is such that they're at loggerheads, you know.
Bush obviously sees that his historical role, he has decided that his historical role is to be someone who stands up to dictators of various stripes and refuses to be diplomatic at all. This is certainly going to be difficult for the professional diplomats. Up to now, the administration has been divided between the State Department professionals who wanted to use talks to solve these problems, and the hardliners who are in the Pentagon and also in the National Security Council, who
and the Congress.
And the actual policy that seems to be followed is what Victor Cha, who is a scholar who is now the Korea man in the National Security Council, he coined the term hawk engagement. And what this basically means is you go through the motions of talking. Give North Korea a chance, if it wants to talk, in this case these six-party talks. But what you're basically doing also is giving North Korea enough rope to hang itself with other nations that are involved in the process, so that you end up with a consensus among countries that might back you in going to the United Nations Security Council, for example. Or in the extreme, which I don't think we can rule out entirely, a preemptive strike, a preemptive military strike against North Korean nuclear facilities. So
isn't that a totally insane and irresponsible thing to do? Because Clinton thought about that in 1994, and it was pointed out to him that with artillery alone, the North Koreans could turn Seoul into a sea of fire, as they have said.
Right.
So how could you preempt nuclear facilities without preempting the entire North Korean army, which would mean you'd have to fire a whole bunch of nukes?
Right. I don't know what the thinking is. Maybe the thinking is that South Korea has become so close to North Korea under the last two presidents with their sunshine policy that North Korea would not attack South Korea, but would rather try to attack Japan, or try to attack only the American troops in South Korea, or something like that. I don't know what the thinking is. It is very dangerous to contemplate, and we also don't know. You know, there's always this talk of smart weapons that can just do their task and cause no collateral damage and so on. So far, we haven't seen them actually in existence. But, you know, if the Pentagon suddenly had a breakthrough and developed those, then you might see the White House very, very tempted to use them and kill Kim Jong-il and wipe out his nuclear capabilities at the same time.
Just like they wiped out Saddam Hussein, you mean?
You're right.
Right. Bradley Martin, again, you're the author of a new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. You're formerly the Asia Bureau Chief and the editor of Newsweek and the Asia Wall Street Journal. You spent a lot of time, obviously, both in Asia and in North Korea. There are things worse than Kim Jong-il, are there not, in the bizarre, secretive politics of North Korea?
Oh, yes. I mean, some of his military men are certainly nastier people than he is. There was one I quoted in my book who spoke at a briefing session attended by one of the defectors I interviewed, and this man said, "Well, we should wipe out all the South Koreans because they'll never agree to live under our ideology. And he said, we have enough chemical weapons to do it. I rather doubt they have enough chemical weapons to do that, because chemical weapons are perishable, and you have to keep making more and more of them in order to have that kind of threat. But it's the kind of genocidal thinking there that's the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect to hear from Kim Jong-il himself, but here's one of his subordinates. It illustrates that there are some very, very militaristic people under him. And of course, if you wipe him out, or you manage to have a coup or somehow get rid of him, the most likely people to come to the fore would be the strongest of the military men, and the strongest of the military men are likely to be the most ideologically intense and anti-American, anti-foreign elements in the country, I'm afraid.
And don't they keep their 1 million-man army in a kind of cocoon of unreality? So these people are just as fanatical. I mean, they expect to die at any rate, don't they?
Right. That has been the case, and as far as we know, it's still the case, that they are isolated from the rest of society during their hitches, which last from around 10 years. They're not allowed to date during that time. They seldom return home. So they don't really know what other people are thinking. So even if the rest of the North Koreans are starting to get a little bit fed up with Kim Jong-il and his regime, which we actually don't know whether that's the case or not, but even if they were, then the military would be perhaps the last to be involved in that. They would be the loyalists who would, and of course they have the weapons.
So, Bradley Martin, explain to our audience why the nuclear weapon is so important to Kim Jong-il, and why, by extension, our, isolating him is actually counterintuitive.
Well, he feels he needs nuclear weapons, even though he has a million-man army. He feels that his conventional forces are overwhelmed by the opposition forces. He has old equipment, and for the most part, his economic situation is such that his pilots can't train very much. They even have difficulty coming up with gasoline for the jeeps and the military trucks, so that you have a lot of walking going on. So he feels that, okay, he's got a lot of soldiers, and they tend to be pretty loyal, but it's not enough to deter the United States, which is always developing these more and more high-tech weapons. And he knows very well that Bush and a lot of other people in Washington want to see him personally dead. And so you can see that he would like to have a whole card, in this case, nuclear weapons, that he could use to make people stop and think before they attack him.
Well, just finally, Bradley Martin, what do you think, just assuming that in the next weeks or months that North Korea will test a nuclear weapon, it's probably AQ Khan designed, it's not entirely sure that it's going to be effective, but let's say they get a detonation.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the neighborhood?
You're gonna have a very frenzied meeting in the White House, and there are going to be people calling for a bombing attack. There are going to be people calling for various kinds of military measures against North Korea. Even if they restrain themselves, then North Korea would possibly have offended China by doing this. China has been able to look the other way and assume that North Korea is really not pushing forward that hard with its nuclear weapons program. And China is the one holdout on the Security Council. China has a veto, of course, and if the United States wants to go and demand harsher measures from the UN Security Council, it needs China to change its mind. China might change its mind as a result of a nuclear test by North Korea. So in any case, North Korea would be guaranteeing harsh measures against itself of one sort or another, or pretty close to it. Now, whether they feel they can stand up against such harsh measures, they have all these decades. I mean, we've pretty much thrown everything we had at them, short of war. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what good any further sanctions might do. And of course, that's going to be the thinking of the hawks in Washington as well. They're going to say, sanctions, smanctions, let's just get over there and blow them to smithereens, which is a very, very common feeling among hawks in the United States.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Bradley Martin.
Thank you very much.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Bradley Martin, who is the author of Under the Loving Care, The Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. He serves as the Asia Bureau Chief and Editor of Newsweek and the Asian Wall Street Journal. I learned this week, well, we all did, of the death of America's most decorated living soldier, Colonel David Hackworth. Colonel Hackworth was unusual as a warrior, given that he was a political progressive. The impression you get is that all the military are Republicans. The Air Force Academy is now run by born-agains, but that's not true. And Hack received a lot of awards, 80-plus medals. He was went on issues and answers in the Vietnam War to say it was a lost cause. The military was so mad at him, they tried to kill him. They eventually before they court-martialed him, he was able to resign. He went in exile to Australia. He bought a farm near where I grew up. And he, one morning, a group of Boy Scouts were camping on his property, and he went down at the dawn, woke them all up, lined them up, and handed out all of his 80-plus medals to them, including 2 Distinguished Service Crosses, 10 Silver Stars, and 8 Purple Hearts. And then he came back, and he worked hard fighting against the nuclear arms race. He was always a warrior. He fought against, most of all, against lying politicians, the kind of politicians, the lying amateurs who've gotten this country into this war. He hated the ticket-punching perfume princes in the Pentagon, the people who brought you those poor dimwits who were being scapegoated for Abu Ghraib, the people who lied about Pat Tillman's death, who were lying about the shooting of the Italian journalist who was shot in the back, who are lying about the wounded in Iraq. That's at least 3 times more than they say. And he had a lot of enemies in the Pentagon. Years ago, Arianna Huffington did a hit piece at the behest of these people, as did David Martin of CBS News. Then when Dan Rather was threatened with a lawsuit, he eventually reversed, apologized to Hack. And then later, Hack gave Dan Rather the Abu Ghraib story, the scoop. We just handed it to him. His medals were restored by General John Howard, one of the soldiers who fought with him. All the people who fought with him loved him. He was a great guy to hang out with. And if you're ever in a dangerous situation, you couldn't ask or wish for anybody better to be your leader. So I miss you, Hack. This program is produced by Louis Vandenberg. It is the engineers Mark Maxwell, Carol Coote, and Rusty Wynn are the assistant producers. I'd like to thank Katya Krininya, who helped us with our Russian guests this morning and has been helping me with some translations here in the studio and mispronunciations. I thank you, Katya, for joining us today.